it is gone! A two-run home run for Rhys Hoskins into the second deck for Bryce Harper.
Swing and a miss, he got him!
And Aaron Nola leads two. Segura on the run, reaches up and makes the grab!
Swing and a miss, struck him out!
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 330. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. And this is the Joe Girardi podcast. The Phillies have a new manager. They've gone and hired former Yankees manager and Marlins manager, I guess, for 1 year there. Joe Girardi is now in the fold as the 55th manager in Phillies history. We're also going to talk about the first couple games of the 2019 World Series, and I'm going to get you an update on how the Phillies prospects are doing in the Arizona Fall League with MLB.com reporter William Bohr. He's going to be buying a little bit later and a little bit just to let you know how Alec Bohm, Spencer Howard, Connor Siebold, all those guys are doing. But joining me for the first part of the podcast to talk about the Joe Girardi news is Paul Boyer, fantastic writer for The Good Fight. You can follow him on Twitter at Paul_Boyer. Paul, we got Joe Girardi in the fold, man. How's it feel?
John, 330 episodes, man. That kind of win total gets you into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, man, when you pile it up like that, it's hard. It's kind of funny. It doesn't feel like 330, and then you look at the number. Yeah, it's quite a little bit. We're cranking them out here, my man. When the Phillies keep making news, we'll keep cranking them out, you know?
Yeah, and you know what? Speaking of 330 wins, how about that for a three-year total on this new manager's contract?
Hey, I like you. I like where your head's at.
Yeah. Why not?
Let's shoot the moon, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just to get right into it, This is great. As far as managerial hires are concerned, and none of us really know anything when we're bringing a manager to the fold, how he's going to coalesce with players on a team that's not fully assembled and how many are going to like him. And in this team's case, who was responsible for his hiring and who wasn't. None of that matters. Right now, as far as I'm concerned and as far as I'll go, this is probably the most excited I can be about a managerial hire.
Right.
I think, you know, this is the kind of guy that this team needed. We saw that they didn't respond totally perfectly to the rather drastic, relatively out-of-the-box thinking that that Kapler and his staffs put out there over the last couple of years. It didn't quite work, not just with the players, but with everybody out here too, where there was a lot of confusion. There was a lot of, you know, he was really just a lightning rod.
Yeah.
Gabe was, for better or for worse. That's just the kind of guy he was. The reactions that we all had to him, and, you know, some of us who had more extreme reactions than others one way or another, were just kind of drawn to that. It seemed to be evoked. He was evocative in that way. It just sort of distracted us, I think, at times from what was actually going on the field. And what happened on the field was not always his fault. You know, I tried to defend some of the things he did as far as I could, mostly last year because, you know, when you have a bullpen that's in shambles, there's only so much you're going to be able to accomplish.
Yeah.
But now we have somebody who carries a lot of respect within the game. We have a guy who has more than a decade of major league managerial experience. We have a guy who has won World Series.
Yeah.
You know,
against the Phillies, actually.
We'll pretend that part didn't happen.
Yeah.
But this is a guy who's won. He has won the dang thing. He's got the chip. He's got his name on a trophy. This is what Philadelphia wants, if I can speak for Philadelphia. We want winners and we want baseball people. What Gabe Kapler was a baseball person, but a little too far to one side, I think, for what we were used to. It was a shock to the system.
Yeah.
And now we've come back closer to the center, gotten a guy with a lot of experience who has won, who is going to know how to communicate, I think, to the media here and talk more on a level that Philadelphia fans are I don't know, expecting is the right word, but he's going to meet them on their level more accurately, I think. In theory, which is as far as any of us can go right now, it looks like the Goldilocks hire in between the two managers that preceded him.
Yeah, Yeah. No, I think that's a great way to put it. Right in between that sweet spot between Pete Mackanin's experience and Gabe Kapler's knowledge of analytics, I think. And that's the thing that made Joe Girardi the favorite among the Phillies, among Phillies executives. And there's going to be a news conference at 1 o'clock on Monday, and we'll hear right from the horse's mouths as to why they decided to go with Girardi over Dusty Baker and Buck Showalter, who also would have been good selections, but very different selections. Girardi seemingly has a better grasp of analytics than either of those two guys and seems to be the guy that everybody wanted. Most Phillies fans, I did a poll, an informal Twitter poll, but I think it mirrored what I saw the general consensus was online. But about 75-80% of people wanted Joe Girardi over those other two guys. And it was a historic hire. I mean, he is the 55th manager in Phillies history. He's the first manager since Steve O'Neill in 1952 to come to the Phillies, having won a postseason series before he arrived. Yeah, like Steve O'Neill had won a World Series prior to coming to the Phillies. So, I mean, it's been, my goodness, it's been 70 years since the Phillies have hired a manager with this kind of pedigree. And you mentioned it. He spent 1 year as the Marlins manager. It was his first year as a skipper. Won the Manager of the Year award with a losing record that year. That's the kind of job he did. Of course, beat the Phillies in 2009 for a world championship with the Yankees. Had a 562 winning percentage in New York. Made the playoffs six times there. His 910 and 710 regular season record with the Yankees is sixth in victories managing that team behind McCarthy, Joe Torre, Casey Stengel, Miller Huggins, Ralph Houk. Some pretty big names there. Mm. ESPN Stats and Info had this little number. Girardi never finished a season below 500 during his 10 years with the Yankees. By the way, the last time the Phillies finished a season above 500 was in 2011 with Charlie Manuel. And, you know, here's the tough task in front of him, Paul, is that he is looking to become the fifth manager to win a World Series with two franchises. Only four managers have done it before. A guy named Bill McKechnie with the 1925 Pirates and 1940 Reds. A guy named Bucky Harris with Washington in 1924 and the Yankees in 47. Sparky Anderson with the Big Red Machine in Cincinnati and then the 1984 Tigers. And Tony La Russa with the 1989 Oakland A's and then two titles with the Cardinals in 06 and 11. Now, a lot of guys have come close. A lot of guys have taken multiple teams to the World Series. Mm-hmm. And obviously, we'd take that right now. But, but Joe Girardi has a difficult task in front of him. It's very unusual for a guy to take two different teams and win the World Series with two different squads. But I think at the end of the day, this was the guy that they had to get.
Yeah, and you can tell by the other two candidates that they were looking for somebody who had a good reputation, who carried clout, who had been around for a while. They weren't messing around with experimentation this time around.
No.
I think they tried to go outside the box and it bit them a little bit. And so they realized, okay, we have to learn from this mistake and reel ourselves back in a little bit.
But they didn't swing too far the other way, which is what I think is good, you know?
Yes, exactly right. We have somebody in Joe Girardi who has embraced what baseball has become, but still knows how to talk to baseball players on, you know, their primal instinct level and can talk to them like an athlete. You know, not somebody who's necessarily the most numbers inclined. You hear from some of the beats and some people around the team that some of the guys on the Phillies right now are totally different in the way they take in some of these numbers. You have somebody like Rhys Hoskins who is said to want this information, who is said to really seek out this information and try and figure out tendencies and success in different parts of the zone and all of that. And then you have a guy like Bryce Harper who just prefers to go up there and hit and learn with what he sees most often. I'm generalizing here. We need somebody who can speak to both ends of that.
Yeah.
We need somebody who can understand, okay, these are the numbers that are very smart people in operations and R&D are cranking out here. Here's what this means. While also thinking, okay, this guy's feeling a little off today. Maybe he felt a little tight in the bullpen, or maybe he's not seeing the ball as well over the last week. Maybe we give a guy a breather here or there. Finding that human element of the athletes that are going to be out on the field and striking a better balance. We want both of these things. We don't want to go too far in one direction or another, because if you do that, you leave out parts of the information that can help you win these games. You need somebody who can take it both ways, and that's what Girardi looks like to me.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And they used to call him Joe Binder, I think, because he used to have a lot of information. Yeah. He was one of the first guys to really speak that language, and it is important. And, you know, John Heyman reported that Girardi was said to have really hit it off with John Middleton and Matt Klentak and others in the interviews there. Word is he also liked the freedom that he would have in making out the lineup cards and making other moves, which isn't the case everywhere. We're hearing Joe Girardi, one of the reasons that it didn't seem like the Mets were all that interested in him was that they want to have more control over the lineup card. They're looking for a manager who's basically gonna do what the front office wants them to do as far as the lineup. And it sounds like the lineup card is going to be Girardi's. And obviously, I think money probably plays a big factor into it too. The Mets are never gonna pay big money to a manager. It's just not something that they do given their financial problems. Matt Breen also reported that there's gonna be a lot of discussions about who actually hired Girardi to manage the Phillies. Obviously, that was something you mentioned right at the top. The whole process here, who was leading the search. But Breen says, for what it's worth, a source says that Klentak told the baseball ops folks that Girardi was his first choice, and the GM wasn't on board with firing Kapler, but sounds like he is on board with Girardi here. So, I mean, we can talk about the process if we want to, and I think that's a worthy discussion to have, because the owner essentially took over the process here for his general manager and his team president. So, my question to you is, what did you think about the process, and would you have liked to see them interview some guys with less experience? You know, I mean, is it possible that, are you at all concerned about the possibility they're missing out on a guy who's like a brilliant baseball mind and a manager because they only looked at guys who had long track records in the past? Are they limiting their options when they really didn't have to here?
I don't think so. I think that's a really fair question, but I don't think so. And I don't necessarily think that even though the Kapler hire didn't work out, that should preclude them from thinking along those lines in the future, say in 3 or 4 years,
yeah,
if Girardi isn't extended and this doesn't work out for whatever reason, there are probably going to be other changes at that point. But I don't think it should preclude them from thinking outside the box the way they did with Kapler. I mean, look at what the Padres just did. On this same day, they hired Jace Tingler, who was...
great baseball name. Great baseball name. Love the name.
Terrific baseball name. Yeah. Who was in player development with the Rangers, if I'm remembering that correctly.
Yep.
He has some I think it was Dominican Winter League.
Yeah, he's managing in the Dominican right now.
Yeah. So he's got some of that, but that's still a little out of the box. So they're not necessarily thinking conventional, and that's not something that's going to go away. And that could work out for them. I think there are a lot of really, really smart people in this game today. I think there are people who could very well be the next Joe Girardi, who we don't know about, who could very well be the next A.J. Hinch, who, you know, you don't think of them necessarily as somebody who's going to be a superstar manager within 10 years of their last game as a player. But for now, this team was in a different position. The team was in a spot where they couldn't really do that again. They couldn't follow up an adventurous hire with an adventurous hire at this point.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been right. Something had to change. Something needed to be looked at a little differently. I agree with what they did and the way they approached it as far as what we know out in the press, where they were only looking at guys with lots of experience in this case and ones who had at least kind of embraced the ideas that are espoused by new age analytical ideas and different ways of thinking about deploying lineups and defensive shifts and pitching staffs and all of that. I don't necessarily buy that Buck Showalter was so enamored with that, which is why I don't really think he was all that serious a candidate to begin with. But you look at even just Girardi and Baker, these are guys who have learned and have studied the way this game has evolved and the ways they have to manage these teams. And that was the kind of guy that this team needed. We don't really have a ton of time to waste on more experiments right now.
Yeah.
It's not the time to do that. There's a lot of talent on this team. And 2020 should be a pretty good year, but it has to be utilized properly. And I don't think futzing around with all sorts of more like totally beyond the pale stuff or pushing the fringe a little bit too much was the way we needed to go with this. I think we just need to step back inside ourselves a little bit and just kind of let things happen and have somebody play a steady hand.
Yeah.
Keep everybody calm, or at least as calm as you can. You know, not everybody's going to like you, but you want to win over as many hearts and minds as you can. And you want to have somebody who can just let these guys play baseball and not be a distraction.
Yeah, that was a thing, too. There was just too much of a distraction. And you know, some of that distraction was not Gabe Kapler's fault. The distraction began once saw what he looked like. I mean, it really stemmed from the fact that he was so muscular and that he looked like he was in better shape than most of the players that he was going to be managing, that he looked so young. And so right off the bat, he had the blog that everybody kind of gravitated to. And he kind of became a little bit of a punchline months before he ever took the field. And then he was not able to erase that early narrative with winning because he didn't win enough while he was here. It was just it was unfortunate that it didn't work out. But now here you have Joe Girardi. And I got to be honest, I said during the summer that I thought that they should bring Joe Girardi in as, at the very least, a consultant, because I wasn't really sure the Phillies were going to fire Gabe Kapler, for one. But for two, I just felt like Girardi's voice, I thought that he could help this team figure out how to use its analytics better. What works? What doesn't work? What kind of information had he been getting from the Yankees analytics staff that had helped them through the years? And, you know, how had he and the coaching staff been able to translate that information to the players to allow them to be successful? And so I really didn't think that Joe Girardi would ever be the manager of this baseball team. Once it started to look pretty obvious at the beginning of the week that Girardi was the favorite, and then you saw some of the other teams like the Cubs who went out and hired David Ross, it seemed like David Ross was their guy all along, and I have some questions about that hire personally. And then the Mets, who seemed to be looking only at first-time guys with the exception of Girardi. It looked like Girardi was almost a courtesy. You know, they talked to him just as a courtesy as opposed to really considering him seriously. But Girardi could have stayed in broadcasting. He didn't have to take a managerial job. He wants to get back into the mix, but I also don't think he came to Philadelphia as a consolation prize. This seems like a good job. I'm sure he's getting paid really well. I imagine we'll find out exactly what kind of deal it is. We know it's a 3-year deal, so he's going to be here for a few years. And, you know, are you surprised that it did end up being Girardi? When this whole managerial process began, was Girardi a guy you realistically thought the Phillies would be able to grab?
I thought the 1-in-3 chance was legit. I really did think that those three high-profile candidates that were floated at the outset of this whole search were really going to be it. So in as far as I thought there was a minimum 1-in-3 chance that he would be on. So I guess that's relatively optimistic.
Yeah.
I was leaning a little bit more towards Showalter.
Yeah, so was
at
I.
At the start of it. Not necessarily in preference, but just in feel, you know, mostly because of the Orioles connections, just because that's the way
these things seem to
go lately. But yeah, as things developed more and more, and it seemed like Girardi was more of a legitimate option, it made more and more sense. You know, I liked the guy when he was with the Yankees, 2009, notwithstanding, of course. And he's the kind of guy you want. Like, I don't know how many different ways I can say it necessarily, that this is right in the sweet spot in between those two extremes that we just went through. And that's what we needed. Like, this is the right guy at the right time. Now, I don't know if it's all going to fall apart. I don't know if this team is going to go 83-79 and miss the playoffs by 4 games. I don't know if, you know, things are going to get better immediately. And you never know when you hire a new manager. But with everything we know, everything we've seen from this guy being successful for a decade in New York and winning a World Series, and how well he seems to communicate when he's on TV. I know that's a different animal, but he going back to his press conferences with New York, he always seemed eloquent and could give a good answer that would satisfy a lot of people. I don't know what more we could really want out of this.
Well, he's talked in recent weeks and months as it seemed as though he was going to get another shot at managing. He's learned a lot from his time with the Yankees. I mean, he left the Marlins after one season because he had a big blow up with Jeff Loria. And anybody pointing the finger at Joe Girardi for that mess needs to change direction, because all Jeff Loria. For those of you who don't know what that was all about, it had to do with Jeff Loria was yelling at an umpire at a game. The umpire told him to shut him up, and so Girardi apparently got in Loria's face after the game, saying you can't do that. Loria considered firing him on the spot. I mean, it was clear that wasn't going to work, and that's Jeff Loria. We all know what kind of an owner Jeff Loria was. Towards the end of his time with the Yankees, there was a rift that grew between him and Brian Cashman. It seemed like Brian Cashman, I think, wanted to have a little bit more control over what was happening on the field, and Girardi was a little bit was resistant to that. And at some point during the course of any relationship between a manager and their team, unless you're Ron Gardenhire with the Twins and you're going to manage there for, you know, he managed there for like 40 years or however long it was, I'm exaggerating. But, you know, there comes a natural ebb and flow, a time when it's time to be done. I mean, we saw that with Charlie Manuel here in Philadelphia. At the end of the time, it was just time for it to be over, and that was the way it went with New York. But I know he has been criticized because he had a reputation for being a little rough around the edges with his players, that sometimes the communication wasn't there. And he has said in different interviews, I've heard him in some podcasts, that he's learned from that. You know, he would get so focused on winning that day's game that he would sometimes forget how brusque he could be with players. And, you know, I think you learn from every stop along the way. And I think I can't guarantee it. Like you said, nobody knows for sure if it's going to work, but my guess is that he's going to use that as a learning experience in Philadelphia. And he is following a manager that did have good communication skills with his players, it seemed like, mm-hmm. most of the time.
Yeah. And I think that's an important clarification. It's good you brought that up, because I'm speaking about this guy, not as if I know him, of course, but in the present, kind of brushing over what he was in the past and talking about Girardi. He had a reputation of being pretty hardline, I guess, at some times. Not necessarily overly intense, but pretty intense. You know, reports have Kapler letting the players kind of rule their own locker room.
Yeah, that ain't happening with Girardi.
No, it's not. So it'll be a bit of a shock to the system, and we'll see how these guys respond to it.
But like you said, I think that's good.
Yeah.
I think they need it.
So some kind of a change is good, and I think the fact that Girardi has been so open about learning and about adapting and about changing is what has me so convinced. You know, I do like the way he communicates, but I also like that he has taken some of these lessons from the ups and downs, even though it was mostly a successful run with the Yankees, every year over 500. Yeah, that qualifies as pretty successful.
I think so. Well, some people that invaded my timeline today. What has Girardi ever won over the last 10 years? Like, I think we're only... there's a lot of... There's also a lot of that on the Twitter machine, but that's pretty much just the Twitter machine. So
You know what he's won over the last 10 years? One more World Series than we have.
That's right.
I like the willingness to grow, the willingness to learn and adapt, or at least be forthcoming about, you know, having some kind of deficiency and wanting to get better. You know, Kapler admitted to some of that too, but you didn't really see a ton of change, even as the teams faltered in consecutive Septembers. So I'm excited to see somebody else come in and actually put the money where the mouth is and say, okay, here's what I've learned from my time in New York. Here's what I've learned in watching baseball as a detached observer over the last couple of years from a TV booth and behind a desk. Mm-hmm. Let's put it into action. Let's see what these guys can do. I have some ideas, and hopefully they work, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, and we'll see, obviously, pretty quickly here, because, I mean, Girardi is going to get a chance to get involved now with some offseason acquisitions. And when we come back, we're going to just put a bow on the Girardi conversation, because he's got a couple of holes to fill on his staff, some pretty important holes. So we'll talk about that, and we'll get to some thoughts about the first couple games of the World Series. Man, those Washington Nationals, are they the buzzsaw this year? We'll talk about that up next here on Hittin' Season. And we're back on Hittin' Season. John Stolness here with you with the great Paul Boyer from The Good Fight. So just to kind of put the finishing touches on the Joe Girardi conversation, the next step for the manager here, Paul, is to go out and hire himself a hitting coach and a pitching coach. And I know Jim Salisbury mentioned a couple possibilities from his time with the Yankees. Dave Island and Larry Rothschild are guys to watch, he said. And obviously, we don't really know enough about who he could bring over as like a hitting coach, and, you know, how much of a say Matt Klentak will have in that. I imagine he'll probably have to run his guys through the front office. But I mean, I can't imagine Matt Klentak, if Joe Girardi says, I want Charlie Hayes to be my hitting coach or something like that. I just thought of the most random Yankee from like the 90s and early 2000s. Charlie Hayes, a former Philly, obviously.
Yeah, Yankee-Philly crossover.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was on that. I think he made the final out in the 98, World Series? I mean, he caught the final out, I think is what I'm trying to say. In the, either the 96 or the 98 World Series. I forget which one. Anyway, I mean, it's he's going to – I can't imagine Joe Girardi won't have the call, the final call on who his pitching coach and hitting coach is going to be, because he's already got his bench coach, his longtime bench coach from the Yankees is already here, Rob Thompson. That's got to also provide some comfort to Girardi coming here. And so – I guess, you know, what do you think, what does this team need as far as, like, hitting and pitching coaches? I don't expect you to come up with names, but, you know, do you like the idea of bringing a couple of guys from, like, getting the band back together from the Yankees days?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that seems fine enough to me. You know, position coaches and guys on the staff below the manager are positions where I don't really think I've ever had any kind of feeling one way or another.
Yeah,
this isn't necessarily something where if we're in an off season and we have names floated around, I don't really mind, as long as they have some sort of track record that they've coached some advanced professional level. That's usually fine. I'm content to wait and see. It's when the results start coming in or don't start coming in that I start wondering if they were the right hire.
Yeah.
So I try and let the performance run its course and tell the story there. As far as Island and Rothschild are concerned, yeah, those are guys with a lot of experience, and I don't really have anything against them. I haven't studied their track records or their developmental records or anything like that. They just both strike me as guys with good reputations who have been parts of good teams who have each won titles, if I'm remembering correctly, and I would have absolutely no opposition to that. As far as keeping the band together and just poaching Yankees, yeah, fine. The Yankees are a good franchise, but, you know, yeah. Like, if you're going to imitate somebody,
I
know the Yankees haven't won since 2009, oh, boo-hoo. Like, that's a good franchise to emulate. I have no problem bringing a bunch of Yankees coaches in to get this thing off the ground for the first year or two. I think that's great. Sure.
Yeah.
Bring them in.
Yeah. Why not? You know, why not? And, you know, I think the Phillies have learned what they need in a hitting coach and a pitching coach is somebody who can speak the language of the players, but also speak the language of the math nerds who are rolling the abacus beads across, you know?
Yeah. That's the thing. You know,
it's going to be really important. Is that more important than the manager, even like having these coaches in place? Because I hear that a lot. I've heard people say the hitting coach and the pitching coach actually matters more than the manager. And, you know, a lot of people wonder, you know, how important is the manager? You know, we saw Davey Martinez was vilified in his first season and really for the first part of the 2019 season. And now he's on the verge of being a world champion. I mean, it's one of those things, you know, Mike Matheny won a championship with the Cardinals, and then he's generally regarded as a not very good manager. So, I mean, I oftentimes wonder, you know, how important a manager really is.
Winning cures all, man.
Yeah,
winning,
it sure does.
Winning is the great equalizer. It doesn't matter. Like, if you win, nobody really cares. It's when you stop winning or if you never get started winning that really gets people's attention. as far as pitching and hitting coaching being more important, I don't know if it's necessarily a relative argument to the manager, but I will say that I do think it's incredibly important that they keep, like they've done with Girardi, that they keep communication skills toward the top of their list of priorities. In talking with a couple people about Chris Young, they admit that he's a really smart guy. He really knows his stuff, and he's got some good ideas, and he can talk data, and he can talk quantitative research. Like, he can really dice that up. The problem came in translating that to the pitchers, as far as the conversations I've had with folks closer to the team. So you need somebody who can be a more successful conduit than Chris Young was. You need somebody who, yes, can speak that language, but can put it in ways that these players can use to help them grow. You know, that was the biggest thing, especially on the pitching side. We just saw guys either take steps back or stagnate. And that can't happen again. You know, we have a lot of guys in their mid-20s who could theoretically, I'm not going to go full out conspiracy theory here, but could theoretically take steps forward this year if they're still on the team. I can't couch that enough, but I still think they could get a little bit better. And they're not going to do that if the coaches aren't able to help them. And it didn't seem like the coaches were able to help these guys over the last year or two.
Yeah.
So that's all I care about.
Yeah.
I want to see them get better. I want to see improvement.
Yep. And I think we also saw that the coaching staff was trying to ask certain players to do things that they just couldn't do. I think they didn't have the horses in place to do the high fastball, low curveball thing. You know, Zach Eflin obviously couldn't do it. Pivetta couldn't sustain it. Velasquez doesn't have that kind of command. It's not something that they could do. And so we'll see how malleable these coaches are with the group that they have, you know, how they try to mold these different guys. I mean, actually, we won't really see it because we're kind of on the outside looking in, but hopefully the results will tell the tale, as Amen. You just mentioned a minute ago. All right, well, let's move on to the World Series here, Paul, because games one and two, man, what an interesting series we have so far. It looks like the Nationals are on the cusp of running away with this thing. They've won 8 postseason games in a row. Some of these numbers are crazy. To think at one point this year that the Phillies were 10 games up on the Washington Nationals. Can you believe that at one point this year, 10 games up on the Nationals. Since May 23rd, the Nationals have gone 84-40. That's 44 games over 500. Over their last 20 games, including the playoffs, they are 18-2, which is the best 20-game stretch in any of the 15 seasons since they moved to Washington.
Wow.
They're the first team to win the first 2 games of a World Series on the road since the 1999 Yankees. I got another couple cool stats here for you. I mean, winning these first 2 games on the road almost assures you of winning the World Series. In the history of best-of-7 series, 26 teams have gone on the road and won the first 2 games. The combined record of those 26 teams winning the series is 23-3.
Oh, boy.
The only times it didn't happen were in 85 when the Royals came back to beat the Cardinals, 86 when the Mets came back to beat the Red Sox in the Mookie Wilson game, and in 96 when the Yankees overcame the Braves. That was in the Mark Wohlers game. I believe it was in Game 3 when the Yankees came back from like 6-0 down or something like that. So right now, it's all set up for the Nationals here, Paul, and I don't know who you're rooting for, if you're rooting for anyone here in this series, because, you know, for most Phillies fans, rooting for the Nationals is a non-starter, but the Houston Astros have not exactly endeared themselves to the public here over the last week, and some would argue even longer than that.
That's an entirely different fiasco. My personal opinion is, it runs counter to a lot of Philadelphia in that I've never hated the Nationals. I've really never had anything against them. I thought the Natitude era was kind of funny to poke at. but I don't feel anything bubble up in me the way I do when the Braves and the Mets and peak annoyance Marlins, even when they came to town. Yeah. I don't feel it. I haven't yet. Maybe now, once they claim a title, maybe you'll feel like, okay, now we got to beat these guys. Now I'm really going to feel it and get up for these games, and maybe things will change that way. But I've never really been opposed, as far as division rivals go, been opposed to them seeing them take it home. They're a good team. They're full of, you know, mostly likable players. I can't think of anybody off the top of my head who's a real sleazeball, and I'm sorry if that's evading me at the second. I can't think of anybody. They have a guy who could be the next Hall of Famer that we're seeing in his emergence, in the infancy of what could be an incredible career in Juan Soto. We have a Hall of Fame pitcher in Max Scherzer. We have a guy who's reclaimed his status as a transcendent talent in Steven Strasburg. We have a guy named Patrick Corbin who, you know, 9 out of 10 left-handed hitters say throws the best slider they've ever seen in their life. And you have guys like Gerardo Parra and Anibal Sanchez wearing their weird colored glasses, and Adam Eaton and Howie Kendrick going in and doing these weird gear shifting celebrations.
I love that. Man, that was fun. That was. I love that gear shift celebration. You know, that was funny.
Yeah, like I have absolutely no ill will in my heart. The only thing I've been dreading is Nationals fans just spending the whole winter chirping us about Bryce Harper because they can't seem to let that go, when really they would have been a better team with him, and it's not his fault, but they're really good anyway, and Harper's not on the team, so it doesn't matter. That whole part has already got me pre-annoyed, but as far as the actual team itself goes, yeah, absolutely, go take it home. I have no problem with them winning, none at all.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, obviously, I have come at it from a little bit of a different perspective, because as everybody who listens to this podcast knows, I live in the Northern Virginia area, so I live in, I work in D.C. every day, and my oldest son is a huge Nationals fan, as again, everybody knows by now, and he's just, I'm actually feeling, this has been a stressful series for me, because I've been watching him, and really hoping that for his sake, that they win, because, I mean, he's just been so excited, and it crushes him when they lose, and, you know, every kid should be scarred a little bit with their sports fandom, and as an 8-year-old who's already experienced a Stanley Cup title, and now he's going to probably get a World Series title, he's not going to have the pain that I grew up with. But you're supposed to want better things for your children, Paul, and so, you know, I don't want my child to necessarily have to live the life that I led as a sports fan when I was, you know, spent the first 32 years of my life, you know, the 80 World Series, or the 83 Sixers, I was what, 6 when that happened. I wasn't paying attention to the world, so I wasn't conscious of anything until the 08 World Series, and you know, that was for years, for decades, I didn't think a season could end in any other way other than pain. So it's nice that he can have that, and so I'm rooting for the Nationals because of that. The baby shark stuff is, I didn't like it at first. It was really annoying at first. Now it's kind of endearing. It's fine. Yeah, it is what it is. And, you know, it's really remarkable watching a team that just seems to have destiny behind it. And that's what the Nationals seem to have right now. And you mentioned Strasburg a second ago. This is a really interesting storyline. Has a 1.34 ERA right now. Among pitchers with at least 40 postseason innings, his 1.34 ERA is the third best all time, trailing only Mariano Rivera's 0.70 and Sandy Koufax's 0.95.
Man, how you doing?
What? I mean, and to go and beat Gerrit Cole and Justin Verlander, both of them 20-game winners this year. Mm-hmm. First time anybody's done that in games 1 and 2 of a World Series since Don Drysdale and Sandy Koufax of the Dodgers were beaten by the Twins in 1965. The Dodgers,
John,
actually,
the facts are crazy on this episode, man. You are killing me with these.
I did some research, but the Dodgers won that series, by the way. The Dodgers came back to win that series. Regardless, I want to talk to you about the Strasburg thing, because we're seeing a lot of kind of revisionist history now with the whole shutting him down in 2012 thing. Remembering that he was just coming off of Tommy John surgery. They had an innings limit on him in 2012 for people who were under a rock and didn't remember what happened, you know, a few years ago. And the Nationals took a ton of heat for shutting him down early. The Nats made the playoffs. He didn't pitch at all in the postseason. And the Nationals fell short in the National League Division Series. And management took a huge hit for not letting him pitch, for not figuring out a way to keep him going. I maintain that the Nationals did not handle it correctly. I have no problem with them putting together an innings limit for him. It shows that they were very smart to do it, but there was no forward thinking about how to do it. They just used him until he ran out. It was kind of like a car running out of gas. Instead of rationing Stephen Strasburg, which they should have figured out a way to do, start his season later, or only let him pitch 3 or 4 innings for a few starts until later in the season, a smart baseball team could have figured out a way to be able to use him in October rather than not having him. So they did the right thing by not pushing him. Obviously, he's turned into a great pitcher. He's got them close to winning a World Series right now. But I think that they probably could have approached it still in a way that was smarter than what they did back in 2012. What are your thoughts on Stephen Strasburg performing brilliantly now? I mean, he's here and he is putting together quite a show.
He really is. And if this was the plan all along, maybe it wasn't exactly to a T what the plan was going to be. But if this was the plan, if the thinking in 2012 was to make sure he still had a viable arm 7 years later and could pitch up until and through the postseason in any one of those 7 years that the Nationals would get there, well, then it worked.
Yeah.
You know, then it worked. And he has pitched them to very nearly the brink of a title. I don't know if I would have done it differently back in 2012 necessarily. I would have thought about maybe using him as a reliever, but that can get a little dicey when you know bump starters back and forth, as we well know,
sure,
from watching our own players get bounced back and forth. I don't really begrudge them. You know, Tommy John surgery and its long-term effects are still things we're really figuring out, right? Mm-hmm. As the medicine improves and the techniques improve, we see quicker recoveries and we see guys who can sometimes undergo multiple Tommy John surgeries still recover and come back and pitch in the major leagues. We don't really know exactly what a pitcher looks like years on down the line after one of these procedures. Yeah. It's still a relatively new thing. You know, Tommy John had this procedure done, decades ago, but modern medicine is a different beast. And the modern athlete, the modern pitcher is a completely different beast. They torque their arms in ways that guys back in the 70s and beyond could only dream about. So you see a guy like Strasburg who puts incredible spin on his pitches and has incredible power behind it coming back from Tommy John surgery. Yeah, you probably want to be a little cautious with that, especially mm-hmm. if you have long-term plans for your franchise built around him. So I can't go back and say, no, they probably still should have done that differently, because it's hard to argue with the results.
Yeah, it worked out.
You know? It's not his fault that they were dropped out of the playoffs in the LDS the three other times before this year. Yeah. You know, it's not his fault. He was there. He was ready to go. Well, most of the time, I think he was injured for one of those years, but he was there and ready to go. And as you just laid out, he was performing. He was great. Yeah. It wasn't his fault.
Yeah. And just one other thing about Strasburg to kind of put a button in this is that he is the only pitcher taken number one overall to start a World Series game for the team that drafted him. So it just goes to show you, when you take a pitcher number one overall in the draft, this is the only time in baseball history that pitcher has started for the team that drafted him. Garrett Cole also was drafted number one overall, but by the Pirates, not by the Astros.
The facts are just, you're absolutely steamrolling me. This is
the
amazing.
World Series, man. It lends itself to these facts. Ugh. And you know, the Twitter machine is not good for a lot of things, but sometimes it's good for some things. Well, man, listen, we got an interesting couple months now ahead of us with Joe Girardi in the fold. We'll see where they go with hitting coaches and pitching coaches, and whether or not Girardi, inspires this team to make a really hard push on some of the big-time free agents that are out there this offseason. It's going to be another fascinating offseason here covering the Phils. Make sure that you're reading us at The Good Fight and checking out all the great work that Paul Boyer does there. And please make sure that you're following Paul on Twitter at Paul_Boyer. Paul, thanks so much for coming back on Hittin' Season, buddy. I appreciate it.
Johnny, thanks so much, baby. Let's go get bindered.
And up next, let's get a look at what the Phillies prospects are doing in the Arizona Fall League. We're going to talk to MLB.com reporter William Boer. That's up next right here on Hittin' Season. Well, as we all talk about what the Phillies are going to do with the managerial spot and some of the moves they're going to make this offseason, a couple of the keys that are going to be big for 2020 is what kind of production they get from some of their top prospects. And, of course, when we're talking about the Phillies' top prospects, we're talking about guys like Alec Bohm and Spencer Howard, who are both playing in the Arizona Fall League, along with a number of other top Phillies prospects. And joining me to talk a little bit about their progress, what they've been doing out in Arizona, is William Boer, reporter for MLB.com and MLB Pipeline. You can follow him on Twitter at WBOR. That's WBOOR. William, thanks so much for coming on Hittin' Season. How are you, man?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks. And we focus so much on the big league team here with the Phillies. I mean, back when we were going through the rebuild, we did so many podcasts on the farm system and the prospects, because that's all that was, that, you know, we were so focused on the future and we didn't have anything at the big league level to talk about. And obviously the prospects have kind of faded into the background a little bit here as the big league team has gotten better. But I think this is the most exciting contingent of prospects the Phillies have ever sent to the Arizona Fall League, and obviously their two top prospects are both there and both playing. So let's jump right in here and talk about Alec Bohm, because he's been raking since he's gotten to Arizona, hasn't he? 19 games, I think I saw he's hitting .361 right now with a little bit of pop. What have you heard, what have you seen from Alec Bohm out there in Arizona?
Yeah, to your first point just about the prospects, whenever you send your first two and then a former number one overall pick in Moniak, it's definitely an exciting group as a whole. But yeah, back to Alec. He has, as you said, he's been raking. He's hitting .361, slugging .528. Like he's simply just, every game I've seen him, he's hitting the ball. Even the outs he's making loud contact. He's hitting the ball hard. He's only homered twice, but both of those are within the past, 10 days or so. So like that was my first thing. If we would have done this podcast a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, I would have been like, hey, he's raking, he's collecting a ton of hits, but I haven't seen any power. But over the past 10 games, I'm looking at now, the two homers came, and he's also got four doubles over that span. So the pop has started to show up a little bit more as well. So that's obviously intriguing. And then anytime the fall league, Arizona tends to be a little easier to hit in, but anytime you're hitting 361, obviously that's a good number. And you're facing advanced pitching here. He got 63 games this year at the double A level. So you're seeing more of those kind of high quality arms right now. So that should springboard in more, into 2020, and we'll see when he makes his way up to Philadelphia, and probably maybe late 2020, more likely 2021.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what the talent level was like there in the Arizona Fall League, and obviously the Phillies are sending their top two guys, and both of whom reached Double A. But are there teams that have sent some of their Triple A arms to the Arizona Fall League? And because I think we're all under the belief that Bohm is going to start next year in Triple A with Lehigh Valley. Is he seeing some of that kind of some of those kinds of pitchers out there in the AFL?
Yeah, there's some AAA arms here. It all varies because of the way teams approach it. Like the A's sent Daniel Gossett, who's a major leaguer, but missed the whole year with Tommy John. So they just wanted to get some innings. So in that sense, you do have a major league arm here. But there's some AAA guys, a lot of AA guys. You're seeing all sorts of stuff, players here that have been fully healthy, players here that are just working on something. So maybe they're throwing a crazy, you know, high percentage of curveballs or whatever. But overall, like when you're hitting like Bum is, it's obviously a good sign. And you are facing like quality arms. Like it varies on their goals and what each organization has set up for each guy. But overall, I would probably call the Fall League like AA+.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Right between AA and AAA, yeah.
Okay, that's kind of what I was thinking, like just a little bit in between AA and AAA there. So, one of the things about Bohm is that I think most people inside the Phillies organization like his bat. Some of the question is about his glove, whether or not he's going to be able to play third base or whether he's going to have to play first base, whether he has any future at all, maybe in the outfield in one of the corners. Based on what you've seen so far, how has he looked defensively? Has he had a lot of chances, and has he managed to hold his own wherever he's played?
I think, yeah, I don't know if he's played outfield out here or not. I certainly haven't seen it.
I would doubt it. I don't think he played any outfield in the system this year, so.
Yeah, I have seen first. I have seen third. He holds his own would be the best way to put it. Like, he doesn't look like a plus defender or anything out there, but especially if he's hitting, it doesn't look like the kind of guy that's going to cost you games defensively either. Mm-hmm. You know, may not make the stellar play, may not steal you any bonus outs, but he looks like the guy that's going to make the plays that need to be made. And I think if you've got someone hitting the way he's hitting, that's really all you need. But I will say he's committed to improving defensively. How much progress he's able to make, how much better he's able to get, we'll see. But he is one of the players that I see out there taking extra ground balls, actually kind of focused taking ground balls during BP rather than like, you know, trying to field them between the legs or whatever.
Oh, okay.
Some of the like fun stuff. So I think there's something that Phillies fans should be excited with there. I mean, obviously putting in the work doesn't necessarily always translate to results or people meeting their ceiling, but you would much rather have someone putting in the work and willing to do that than not.
Spencer Howard is the other big Phillies prospect there. And I was seeing some notes that MLB.com had up on him. 2.45 ERA for him right now in 18 and a third innings, 23 strikeouts over that time. He's only given up 9 hits and walked 7 as a 2.45 ERA. And I've seen some of the videos that have been posted of Spencer Howard, and He looks like the fastball is still in that mid to upper 90 range, but it looks like he's starting to develop maybe a pretty good changeup to left-handed hitters. I saw one that just dropped down and away out of the zone that just looked completely unhittable. What have you seen from Spencer Howard so far in his outings?
Yeah, and the cool thing is you mentioned the videos. We actually have access to StatCast and, like, higher quality videos for the Scottsdale team than others just because they're playing at Salt River Fields, whereas I've been shooting cell phone video for some of the other prospects. So the fact that you're talking about Phillies who are on Scottsdale actually makes it a lot better for you to be able to view that video.
Yeah.
But yeah, Spencer's looked good. He's looked like a top 100 prospect in baseball, which obviously he is. He's definitely looked the part. Obviously an abbreviated season, only pitched 30 something innings in the year. So this fall league stint is mainly just to make this year not a waste, kind of get back on track, get some innings, and then head into 2020. But he's looked good out here. I've seen, I believe, two of his starts off the top of my head. I may have seen a third in there, but I'm not sure. The first one I saw was kind of up and down. It was, I think, three runs over like three innings or something like that. But he also struck out seven in that outing. So you kind of saw, you saw the really good, you know, the change of the slider and the seven strikeouts. But then you also saw where he would miss a few pitches, leave them hanging or whatever. And that led to the three runs. But then the next start, I saw him a few days ago, and it was four innings, two hits, zero runs. And I was like, oh, okay, this is what everyone's talking about. This is the guy. Like, before it was flashes, and then, you know, that other start was like the full thing. So I think with him, it's just a matter of putting it all together every 5 days. But I'm definitely, because this is, I hadn't seen him before the fall league. I'd heard everything, I'd talked to people, I'd seen video, but this is the first time I've seen him in person, and I get it.
Okay, that's good to know. I mean, a lot of people are thinking he could make an impact in the starting rotation as early as next year, and I'm kind of cautioning that a little bit just because of the lack of innings that he's pitched, and he's obviously trying to make up for some of that here in the Arizona Fall League. My thinking is that maybe you delay the start of his 2020 season, don't get him started until May, give him a full off season, and maybe start him a month later so that if the Phillies do need him in 2020 for next year, maybe they can, because there's certainly going to be an innings limit restriction on him next season, that maybe they can run out of those innings in September as opposed to running out of those innings in August. Does that plan make any sense to you?
Yeah, assuming that this, obviously with the caveat of, you know, the stuff and the consistency develops accordingly. But yeah, considering he only threw however many innings this year, he's not gonna have a huge innings limit. Like, they're not gonna throw him for 200 innings or anything crazy next year. And you would think that since he still does need time for develop, by the time he's ready for Philadelphia, it would be, I don't know, August. So yeah, that does kind of make sense to go the extended spring training route, just save some innings, and then that way he can be ready when he's ready. I think you either do that, or if you want him pitching every 5 days just to get into a routine, then maybe you do something where he starts the year, you know, at the beginning of the year, but all his starts are like three innings. Kind of like, I think the Blue Jays did that with Nate Pearson this year. I'd have to look up what the numbers were, but I think every other start was roughly like three innings and five innings, three innings and five innings or something like that.
Okay.
So that way he pitched a full season, just to the durability. And some of that is like, you know, like the weight training and just like really getting into a routine.
Yeah.
Okay. But also obviously when you're going three and five, they're just saying, don't waste your arm.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Okay. Well, that makes sense. I like both of those plans. One other starting pitcher that's down there is 23-year-old Connor Siebold. who is they've removed him from the roster, so he's all done in the Arizona Fall League. But in four starts, he had a 1.06 ERA in 17 innings, a 22-3 strikeout to walk ratio while he was down there. What did you hear about Connor Siebold? Because he kind of gets lost in the shuffle a little bit with all the excitement around Spencer Howard, but he looked good in the Phil system this year, and based on the numbers, it sure seems like he pitched pretty effectively in the Arizona Fall League.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, those numbers are ridiculous. I saw him twice, actually, of four starts. So apparently my schedule and Connor's lined up really well. He looked good. And like you said, when you think about this Phillies Fall League contingent, you think about Baum, Howard, Moniak, and you do kind of forget about Siebold. But he may have been – he was definitely one of the more impressive pitchers here while he was here before he was shut down. Not a ton of overpowering stuff, you know, is not like triple digits or super nasty break on a slider or anything, but he's a guy who knows what he has. The command was good. He's able to locate it all over the zone, and he knows how to pitch as far as sequencing, as far as moving up and down and in and out. It was really impressive just to watch him work, because he knew what he was doing. He wasn't one of those guys that's gotten by so far this year, that hasn't gotten by so far in his career just by blowing it by people or anything like that. So I think it was a good development and a good fall for him to just further work on sequencing, further work on throwing in new catchers and all that, and just kind of learn what it takes to get better hitters out.
You mentioned Mickey Moniak just a little bit ago, the former number one overall pick. Looking at the numbers, again, 14 games, not a great slash, 169, 210, 254. He hasn't gone deep. He has just four extra base hits. The numbers make it look disappointing. What have you seen from Mickey Moniak?
Unfortunately, the numbers kind of match the reality. Looking at here, he's 0 for his last 19. 1 for 23, if you go back an extra game there. He just hasn't been able to hit really well. He's been a solid defender. Saw him make a nice diving play the other night. He's had definitely flashes, but he hasn't been able to hit well. And I think that's particularly disappointing. I mean, it's always disappointing when a number one pick doesn't hit well, but because he seemed to fare well in Double A this year to end the year. Once he got there, I know his second half was a little bit worse than his first, but advanced to Double A, hit 250, and you're like, okay, maybe he's getting back on track, especially since he had a solid 2018 season. Mm-hmm. But then he's come here and he's just struggled, and I don't know if he's overmatched, if it's just he played 119 games this year and then they sent him out for six more weeks. That's the other thing in the Fall League, is sometimes these guys are just tired. This is, you know, more than they've ever played. It started in, spring training starts like mid-February.
Yeah.
It's October 23rd. It's a really long, long year. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's just fatigue. I haven't talk to Moniak, but sometimes, you know, if they come here and they're told to work on hitting the ball the other way or something like that,
yeah,
trying to inside out every pitch is sometimes going to lead to outs. So there's that component as well. But just, yeah, strictly from what I've seen and from who I've talked to, it hasn't been an overwhelmingly great Fall League for him by any means.
Just a couple other guys, and I don't need you to give me a comment on each one of these guys, but the other Phillies players that are there, Jojo Romero, he's been working as a reliever while he's been there. He's looking pretty good. I think he's given up one run in 9 1/3 innings. But they also have shortstop Nick Maton, left-hander Zach Warren, outfielder Josh Steven, and third baseman Jose Gomez, all playing in the Arizona Fall League. Any of those guys pop up on your radar as having a particularly good Arizona Fall League?
Yeah, I really like Romero. It's hard evaluating relievers in the Fall League is hard. Evaluating them's fine. The issue is like we get the starting pitchers and you don't necessarily know when a reliever is going to pitch. So it's sometimes hard to track them down. But Romero's impressed me the couple outings I've seen. He looks like a guy that could contribute regularly fairly soon. I haven't seen him throw much because he's a reliever, and you know, so it's one inning here, one inning there. But yeah, I've seen him two or three times, and I really liked it. Plus, he was a guy that was kind of on my radar before, since I'm out in Arizona, and you mm-hmm. obviously went to junior college out here.
I'd seen him before,
you know, years ago. He's better now than the pitcher he was then, which obviously is a good sign and ideal. But yeah, so far he looks good. I want to, obviously only a few games left, so hopefully I get to see another one or two outings from him.
Well, we'll keep an eye on these guys, and hopefully some of the big guys can finish strong. Hopefully Mickey Moniak can just have a couple good games to finish things off to hopefully send him home feeling a little bit better about his time this fall in Arizona. Make sure that you're reading William Boor's stuff at MLB.com and for MLB Pipeline. Again, follow him on Twitter at WBOOR. William, thanks so much for coming on Hittin' Season, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
And now it's time for your stat of the week. New Phillies manager Joe Girardi is the only guy to win a Manager of the Year award despite having a losing record for his team that season. He earned it in 2006 by going 78-84 in his only season managing the Marlins. That should tell you all you need to know about the state of the Miami Marlins when Joe Girardi was the manager there back in 06. Folks, that'll do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. My thanks to Paul Boyer and William Boor for coming on the podcast. If you haven't already, folks, make sure that you check out the Patreon for Hittin' Season. It is at patreon.com/hittin'season. And also tell a friend about the Good Fight podcast feed. You'll hear Hittin' Season. You'll hear Justin Clue and Liz Rocher talk about the Girardi hiring. And they're also going to get into a little bit of their thoughts from the 2019 World Series. And they'll take a look back at the 09 World Series the Phillies played against Girardi and those New York Yankees. That'll be on a new episode of Continued Success. That'll be out Friday as well. And don't forget to check out new editions of The Dirty Inning. We had a new one out this week, and we'll have another one coming out in a couple weeks as well, so make sure you are checking those out as well. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I'll talk to you next time right here on Hittin' Season.